This short talk is about the concept of unruly complexity. It draws from my 2005 book, Unruly Complexity, Ecology, Interpretation, and Engagement. That book can be read in three ways. There's a sequence of case studies, there's an autobiographical story that runs through the book, and there's a conceptual argument. In this talk, I'll focus on the conceptual argument. When you hear a that means go to the next slide. What if everything is already unruly complexity? Well, if I said that, you'd say, what does unruly complexity mean? Well, my definition is that it refers to situations that consist of heterogeneous components that are built up over time and are subject to ongoing restructuring and are embedded in wider dynamics. Alternatively, equivalently, there are situations that lack definite boundaries. What goes on outside continually restructures what's inside, and diverse processes come together to produce change. Okay, let me illustrate that. Here's a picture of serious soil erosion in an area of Oaxaca in central Mexico, and the research here was done by Raul Garcia Barrios, his brother Luis Garcia Barrios, and Elena Alvarez Villa in the 1980s. This next figure is my reconstruction of their work. Now, you're not going to read all the details, but I'll go through and indicate what's important. First, let's note that a timeline across the bottom of 500 years, and that there are various strands. The top three are what's going on locally in that area, and the last one is what's going on externally. So there are heterogeneous components. In this picture, you'll see issues about terracing, issues about the cajetes, the sowing of the corn, the management of diversity, that's in the agroecology. You'll see things like the revolution and the independence on the external situation. You'll see demographic collapse. And in both cases here, actually, there was a demographic collapse and the terraces that had been highly productive were abandoned, and they led to erosion in both cases, where both cases is the time of the Spanish invasion and the time of the revolution and independence. In between, they are built up again. So these processes build up over time, in this case over centuries, subject to ongoing restructuring. So the demographic collapse with the Spanish invasion led to labor scarcity, and so the people took on labor-saving practices of goats, which had been brought in by the invaders, but the goats make erosion worse. They brought in plowing, they brought in wheat, new crops. But gradually, as the church took over control, they recreated a system that would of the caciques, the rich Indians who could mobilize the labor of the poor Indians, something like a feudal system, and gradually they rebuilt the terraces and maintained the discipline of the labor so that the sustainable maize production built up. Well, the brief story is the revolution undermined those institutions and the agroecology, and the population in this case didn't collapse from diseases, but from out-migration. Embedded in wider dynamics. So I've already mentioned the Spanish invasion, already mentioned independence, the revolution. Well, with the revolution, you also had cheap urban food policies and industrial development and land reforms, and more recently, economic neoliberalization. And all those wider dynamics have an influence on what happens in the supposedly local area. So for example, in the recent century, once you had industrial development, money could be brought back by the emigrants to their local area, and money became a source of prestige, where previously, during the previous centuries, your position in the corn production, your status in the kaheti sowing system, was much more a source of prestige. This is a brief. Okay, so we can also say that it lacks definite boundaries. What goes on outside, in quotes, continually restructures what's inside. Diverse processes come together. So that's why there are four strands drawn here. If we tried to explain the soil erosion just using the population, we would say population collapse leads to environmental degradation. But that's too simple. It's really the labor, the lack of labor, and the labor is organized in a system which of agroecology, and it's organized by local social economic institutions. So that's what is mean by diverse processes come together. Okay, that was an illustration of the concept of unruly complexity. So let's get back to the question. What if everything is already unruly complexity? Well, the first answer is that it makes a qualitative difference in the analysis of causes and the implications. To illustrate that in a simple way, let's take this teaching example I use. Imagine these two islands. They have the same land area and quality, the same initial population and growth rate, 3% a year, which means the population doubles every generation, which means the land per unit person halves every generation, and they have the same technical capacity. So I ask my students, what's going to happen? And what would you do about it? And what more might you want to know before you decide what to do? And generally the responses are, well, eventually the people are going to have not enough land to survive, so they need to either use the land more efficiently or reduce their population growth rate. But one thing I didn't say is that the two islands have very different land distributions. The first island has equal land distribution, and the second one has this very unequal land distribution. Now I ask the students to be on the second island and decide what to do. But I divide them into the three groups: the rich, the poor, and the middle. So the rich sometimes say that the poor should be involved in contraception. The poor sometimes say, I'll marry my children off to the rich, or I'm going to leave the island, or I'm going to be a revolutionary and take back the land that the rich took from my grandparents. The middle talk about, let's not rely on the land so much, let's build industry, let's build education to help the poor use their land more efficiently and use contraception and so on. And contraception comes in there, using resources more efficiently comes in there, but very quickly we have issues of politics and economics and who's got the guns and how to defend themselves and history. Very quickly we have all the elements of what I would call the dynamics of inequality. What you should note is the poor people are going to have a squeeze on how much land they've got for subsistence several generations before anyone on island, on the first island, has a problem. So would we call this a population problem, a resource problem? Or would we, as the students quickly discover for themselves in the second case, call it an issue of the politics and economics, the culture that relates to unequal societies? The last thing I should say on this case is there's nowhere in the world that has a land distributive island, the first island, but that Nicaragua and El Salvador had land distributions quite similar to the right-hand island and in the 1970s, and one country had a revolution, the other had a long civil war towards among the revolutionaries and the conservatives. So you see that if, in this schema, if we just treated population as the entity, the thing we're focusing on, everyone as the same kind of thing, we would get the growth rate of population and eventually there'd be a squeeze on the land. And that was the kind of analysis students give when they first look at the two islands. But then when I introduced this extra information, it was a simple account. I didn't talk about the details of particular political families in Nicaragua and so on. But it opened up things. It asked us to consider, well, is there a place that the poor people can migrate to? Is there a source of weapons that the rich are going to buy to defend their land? Is there a history of organizing around these different interests? And so on. It's not the final analysis. It's not telling us how we would get involved in any particular situation. Each particular situation is going to be different, but it points to that. So it's a simple scenario, a simple theme that opens up. And the simple theme is this one, that you can get a qualitative difference in analysis once you pay attention to dynamics among unequal components. So what it points to is making a particular account in a local situation that has these differentiations among unequal or heterogeneous units. So that's the overall schema that I use, and you see in this slide that there's a tension or a spring between it. People can like the simple well-bounded systems, they can take them away, they understand them, they can tell them to someone else, but they deflect their attention away from the messy, differentiated, locally particular situations in order to take some of the virtues of the simple well-bounded system. We insert this middle realm, these simple themes that open things up, that pull away from the simple schemes and point to the locally particular accounts, the unruly complexity. So what if everything is already unruly complexity? The first answer is, well, we get a qualitative difference in analysis of the causes and the implications. That leads to a second question, implications for whom? Well, one answer is the researcher who's in some kind of dialogue between the models and the phenomena. That's a basic definition of science. But their dialogue is embedded in a dialogue with diverse social agents to establish significant knowledge. This is not surprising given the perspective that I've introduced about the two islands and about the three levels of schemas. And is subject to ongoing restructuring. Another way of seeing this is that the practice of researchers, a simple scheme is that they're just in a dialogue with the situation study. That would be what science talks about when it talks about itself. But now this is embedded in social interactions to establish what counts as knowledge. And we have a third question then. What's the researcher's role, knowing that there are these two dialogues, these dual dialogues? And that leads to a third level embeddedness, what I'm calling C here. Efforts to pursue social change, where social change might be just simply in your own scientific field or in your own research lab. It might be broader social change towards land redistribution in Nicaragua in the 1970s, for example. So efforts to pursue social change in which the researcher addresses self-consciously their situatedness, the fact that they are embedded in social relations. As it relates to the dialogue with the situation studied, you know, what people say they're doing science for, which is to discover the way the world is and the way the world works. So this same schema is the three levels that I had vertically before and now horizontally. And we have the same kind of tension between people pulling back to the simple scheme that I'm just, as a scientist, I'm just trying to find out the way the world is, and pulling the other way towards recognizing that they always already pay attention to social relations and they try to intervene in them. Even if it's as crude as trying to get a grant by saying this is going to be the cure to cancer. We all know that kind of stuff. So if you put these three sets of three together, you'll get 9 different combinations. And the question is, what is combination C3? That is, looking at the world in terms of differentiated, locally particular accounts, these layers of intersecting processes or unruly complexity, and looking at it in the sense of being engaged in self-conscious efforts to pay attention to the dual dialogues with the situation you're studying and with the social interactions. My answer is that we're talking here about a diverse set of researchers and other social agents coming or being brought together, acknowledging the heterogeneity, the ongoing restructuring, the embeddedness, acknowledge the unruly complexity about both the situations they're studying and their situatedness as researchers. They mobilize simple themes about complexity of the situations and situatedness, but they do it in such a way that they sustain the interaction until new complexity addressing collaborations emerge that people are invested in. So at the end of the book, I summarize that as saying the challenge for researchers is using their knowledge, themes, and other awareness of complex situations and situatedness to contribute to a culture of participatory restructuring of the distributed conditions of knowledge making and social change. Then I say, but that challenge cannot be addressed alone, nor primarily through our accounts of the world. So where can it be addressed? Well, this talk is supposed to be short, and so I'm not going to review places where people are doing this, except to mention one that I'm involved in, which is a New England workshop on science and social change, which for almost 10 years has been pursuing this interaction between being self-conscious about one's social locatedness as a researcher, one's interest in social change, as well as dealing with the complexity of situations we study. And that's the end of my introduction on unruly complexity.